Back to the Bob Davis Podcasts. Podcast 618, New Talkers, is going to be about the American dream. So there's a new study that says the American dream is killing us. Really? We're going to talk about it in Podcast 618. So even if you have a new house, you can have leaky faucets. And if you have leaky faucets or a leaky toilet, you may not know it. But if you do, believe it or not, and I was shocked to learn this, even a drip will add gallons to your water bill. And so a lot of times you'll hear people say, my God, my water bill. Because water in most municipalities is getting rather expensive. It used to be you paid no attention to the water bill. Today, you pay more attention to the water bill sometimes than you do the heating bill. So if you have leaky faucets or you want to have them checked, you need to have a good plumber, and that plumber, of course, is Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems metro-wide from St. Paul. That means the suburbs, too. So on the Minneapolis side of the river, you call 612-927-6488. On the St. Paul side of the river, you can call 651-224-4771, or you can check them out online at ryanplumbing.com. They do residential and business. And if you're in business, same thing. If you have a leaky faucet in the back, you're going to have a water bill and you're going to be like, what the hell's going on here? And I was talking to Greg Ryan about this, and he was like, you'd be surprised how many times we hear people will call and talk about water bill issues. And we look around and we figure out it's a toilet issue or it's a, a leaky faucet or a leaky toilet. Ryan Plumbing and Heating, University Avenue in St. Paul, just west of the state capitol, 651-224-4771 in St. Paul. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, online at ryanplumbing.com. Now, you guys have heard me talking about this company, Ciro3D.com. They make great motorcycle products and accessories, pipes. They make these awesome, badass, heavy pipes. They make foot pegs that attach to the bike's frame and not to some other part. So they're great. They're adjustable. They're very well designed. So if you're a really tall guy, you got room to move your foot pegs around if you want them. And also lighting options. Really badass, great lighting options for your motorcycle. And here's the deal. What you do is go to Ciro3D.com, C-I-R-O-3D.com. And check out the lighting options, whether it is the LED turn signals or the LED lighting option. They're called bat wings for the rear of the bike. Also, great headlights that will help you, see the bike around the cowling and see the road around the cowling, which sometimes can be problems. So remember, Ciro3D.com. I love this company. They're awesome. Click on the banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. Ask for Ciro parts at your Harley dealer. They carry them, or you can get them through Drag Specialties and more. Ciro3D.com. Well, the idea of this podcast has to do with the American dream. I saw a story today about a study, and the person that wrote the article said the study says the American dream is killing Americans. And that was the one story in all the stories that came out today, whether it's about Susan Rice or tax reform or all the other crazy political stories that are out there, or the subway thing in Russia, the attack in Russia. Of all the things, this is the one that really jumped out at me. And so I have a lot of things about this running through my head. And I think the best thing to do is take a sip of coffee. I have a giant coffee cup with a ton of fabulous Italian roast and Komodo dragon coffee mixed together. And it's at the perfect temperature and it's fabulous. So it's after midnight, perfect time for me to do a podcast. You might hear a plane, especially since we're in stereo. You might be able to hear a plane flying over, but I think pretty much they've all landed. This term, American dream, gets thrown around a lot these days, most of the time indiscriminately. So I'm going to start the podcast by rooting myself because I have so many things to get to mentally. I'm going to root myself by talking about what some say or what really the definition of the American dream actually is. What is something called the American dream? Basically, it started with James Truslow Adams, who coined the term, but it started with the Declaration of Independence. This is that basically, and this is Truslow Adams, derivative of the Declaration of Independence, but that is that the ideals of freedom, equality, and opportunity traditionally held to be available to every American, and that a life of personal happiness and material comfort as traditionally sought by individuals in the U.S. is, in fact, the American dream. Now, he coined this, James Truslow Adams, in 1931. In his book, Epic of America, he wrote, "The American dream is that dream of a land in which life should be better and richer and fuller for everyone, with the opportunity for each according to ability or achievement. It is a difficult dream for the European upper classes to interpret adequately, and too many of us ourselves have grown weary and mistrustful of it." This is back in 1931. "It is not a dream of motor cars and high wages merely, but a dream of social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain to the fullest stature of which they are innately capable and be recognized by others for what they are, regardless of the fortuitous circumstances of birth or position." To take it a little bit of step further, I hate to quote Wikipedia, but it's perfect for this purpose. The reason I hate to quote Wikipedia is Wikipedia, if you write an academic paper, it's not acceptable to use Wikipedia as a source. But in a prosaic sense, it is. "The American dream is a national ethos of the United States, the set of ideals, democracy, rights, liberty, opportunity, and equality, in which freedom includes the opportunity for prosperity and success and an upward social mobility for the family and children achieved through hard work in a society with few barriers." Then it goes to the James Truslow Adams definition in the book Epic of America, right? Further, it finally concludes in this Wikipedia entry, "The American dream is rooted in the Declaration of Independence, which proclaims that all men are created equal with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." So the American dream is problematic generally because it's a modern concept, at least if you separate all the things that have been written about the American dream from the Declaration of Independence. And speaking as a rube, a guy with a high school education, my problem with the idea of the American dream is we've gone from simply stating that we're all created equal and that we all as human beings have unalienable rights, which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as an American dream, to the idea that somehow the American dream is that you'll be prosperous if you work hard and that you'll be happy and that you will have your dreams come true according to your capabilities and your willingness to work hard and so forth. But sometimes those circumstances don't always equal prosperity or quote-unquote success. But that's not what the Declaration of Independence says. It says you are created equal and that you have unalienable human rights, which are you have the right to life, you have the right to be free, to be liberated, to have liberty, and you have the right to pursue your happiness. That's what it says. It doesn't say anything about striving. So I think that Adams, and I'm talking about James Truslow Adams, in his writing of the Epic of America, kind of added to what the Declaration of Independence said, in my personal opinion. So let's get to this study before we get too much time down here. Two Princeton professors did this study, Ann Case and Steve Deaton. They're a husband and wife team. And in this study, they see increasing death rates for non-Hispanic middle-aged white people getting worse. Middle-aged white adults, specifically middle-class white middle-aged adults, were dying younger in 2015 than other groups. Now, if you went to college, don't worry, because college-educated individuals have a life expectancy that continues to get longer, which is one of the reasons that they came to the conclusions that they did regarding the survey. But if you are white and you are middle-aged and you have a high school education or less, your life expectancy nationally is not increasing. Now, the article I read was from the New York Times' Robert Samuelson, who I'm not a big fan of because he writes often about economics, and he tends to be very much a Keynesian and very much a government-centric solution guy, especially when it comes to his supposed economic solutions to things. So he and I are on different sides of the fence, but I don't want to attack the study, and I don't want to attack Samuelson, but I'll just quote him. The main causes of rising death rates among non-Hispanic whites, 50 to 54, men and women, he wrote about this study, are so-called deaths of despair, suicides, drug overdoses, and the consequences of heavy drinking. Since 1990, the death rate from these causes for this group has roughly doubled to 80 per 100,000. These deaths offset mortality gains among children and the elderly, leading to a fall in overall U.S. life expectancy in 2015, according to Case and Deaton. So this goes back to the 1990s. One argument for what's causing this is economic inequality. And it should be said that the authors of the study, Case and Deaton, aren't convinced that economic inequality is the reason. They say they blame it on something called cumulative deprivation, the increasing difficulty people with this level of education have. They cite slow, active, and cumulative social forces that create this sense of despair, which of course leads to these other behaviors. Samuelson in the New York Times and others therefore ask, is the American dream killing us? And so I've given you my immediate problems, because whenever I see something written about the American dream, it irritates me, because the idea is that you're guaranteed something and that the government owes you some sort of level playing field, or the government owes you some kind of help, or we need to help people realize the American dream. We need to help people own their own home. We need to help people have two cars, usually with low interest loans, or in the case of owning a home, literally a subsidy, or health care, literally a subsidy, or retirement, literally an entitlement, and so on. Sending your kids to college, which is now being talked about as something that should be free. Being able to have leisure time, and on it goes. These things, by the way, have nothing to do with the Declaration of Independence, as I said, or even really James Truslow Adams's original codification of the idea of equal opportunity and freedom as an American dream. A lot of people are hostages to unrealized hopes, according to Samuelson. Many Americans are in this precarious position of realizing, and these are my words, not Samuelson's, we're never going to get to the promised land. A realization that usually hits in the 40s and 50s, kind of a modern-day experience of being on the road in the Oklahoma after the Dust Bowl with the Joads in the jalopy on the way to California and finding out that you're not ever going to get to the promised land, although many of them did. But in any case, something as elusive as the definition of the American dream is suddenly responsible for the early deaths of non-white or white non-Hispanic Americans. If I said non-white earlier, I meant white. Now, normally I would attack the study. I would attack the study. I would attack Samuelson. I would attack the idea that there would or could be anything wrong with the quote-unquote American dream. But I'm not going to do that, because what this did for me, this made me think about life. And it made me think about a lot of things associated with life. and living longer than 25 years or 30 years or 35 years, and the struggles in life, and the belief that I have that you have to have a warrior mentality, and you have to understand that your ideas about what is valued in life will change as you get older, and it doesn't matter what your station in life is. And you might actually find at a certain point that you are happier than you thought and surprised by that. And usually it doesn't have much to do with money. Money is nice, but money does not make you happy, although really happy. It'll make you happy, but it won't make you feel whole. It won't give you an inner happiness about the pursuits that you have, especially if you're given money early in life. So we're going to talk about that in this podcast, and I'm sorry for the long intro because I'm still a little loose in terms of what I want to talk about, but I'll tell you what I'll talk about. My family comes from Central Ohio's mining regions. Now, you guys know that I practice yoga. I practice every day, sometimes twice a day. This isn't the commercial about Hydrus. This is about me talking about what I do in my life. And I have started to have some very interesting experiences on the mat. And I don't tell people about it very often, these experiences, because, first of all, people in yoga know exactly what I'm talking about. Because I've seen other people go through these experiences where you're laying there after a class and you hear people weeping. You have these incredibly deep experiences that go by like that, and they have lasting impressions. I have started to believe that, I'm not going to even say believe, but I'm just going to say that I've had an experience recently, a couple of times, more than once, of being in contact with people who have died, being aware of their presence. This isn't them communicating to me. This isn't anything like the dead talking, so don't freak out. This isn't weird stuff like that, but this is a sense of being with those people. That's the best way for me to put it. And sometimes I get things and I draw conclusions, and sometimes I draw great strength from those experiences. And I'll tell you about one experience I had this week that I think this podcast has something to do with. I was laying on the mat after a particularly strenuous class, and I, for no reason at all, started thinking about Central Ohio and got an image in my mind of my great-grandfather sitting at a rough-hewn table with a kerosene lamp with a very furrowed, worried, unhappy brow. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my family. This is on my father's side, their life, and a little bit about the family on my mother's side and their life, because we are from Appalachia, basically. We're from Central Ohio and Kentucky and places like that. And my family came from Wales to be coal miners. So when we're talking about coal mining at the turn of the century in the late 1800s, the mid to late 1800s, when coal mining was not exactly a safe thing, they brought people in from England and Wales and Eastern Europe, and the Eastern Europeans and the Italians, and those people went to northern Minnesota. The English went to northern Michigan, and many of the Welsh went to Central Ohio because they probably came earlier to work in the mines down in that area, also parts of Tennessee and so forth. So we're talking about Scots-Irish, we're talking about Welsh. And they were, for lack of a better term, hillbillies. My grandfather told me stories about miners in pitched Union battles with the National Guard, shooting at each other. Things that would be on the national news today were completely forgotten about. Nobody knew that they were even going on. People dying, people being shot, literally babies falling into tubs of lye. He told me, and my father confirmed this, that men wore guns in town, in the town of Gloucester, Ohio, back in those days, and I can't even find any record of Gloucester, Ohio existing. My great-grandmother had an iron thimble that she wore on her middle finger, and she would whack her grandchildren on the top of the head with that iron thimble, and that was confirmed by my father, who was terrified of this woman, and I think my great-grandfather was also terrified of her as well. So there was lots of stories about backroom poker games that ended in shootings and my great-great-uncle Fierce leaving and going out to North Dakota because he killed somebody in a poker game, or so my grandfather told it. In fact, he said that Grandpa Fierce told my grandfather to go home and get his gun because this fellow was cheating him, and my grandfather did, and watched this happen. And it is true that they did wear guns in town because it was pretty violent, especially during those periods of time with the unions. Now, my mom's side comes from Columbus, Ohio. Same kinds of stories about city life. My grandfather on her side running away to join the Navy around 1914 or 1915, then going into the Army to be in World War I, then coming back, staying in the Naval Reserve, going overseas to be a CB. He helped build the airstrips at Tinian and Saipan for the B-29s and ended up Tinian, but it could have been some other little island over there, having to fight because the Marines left and the Japanese came out of their holes. And he had some pretty interesting annotations in his diary. But among all those stories about these people, I have a couple of conclusions. First of all, I can tell you that life was not a bowl of cherries for the coal miners in Hollister and Gloucester and West Virginia and Southern Ohio and those places. They had to be self-sufficient. They had to be strong. My grandmother, on my mother's side, worked as a store detective. My grandfather was a prison guard. And during the 30s, there was a prison break, and some guy said he was going to come kill my grandfather, and my grandmother sat at a table with a 38 sitting next to her the entire night and played solitaire and said, "I hope he comes because he'll get a surprise that he wasn't prepared for." So this is the kind of people that they were, and I'm not unique in these stories. These are the kinds of stories, if you talk to people who grew up in Chicago, they have all kinds of stories like this with their great-grandparents and their grandfathers. And there were struggles with alcohol. My grandfather drank most of his life and quit in his 50s and was not happy to quit. There were a lot of people in that time dead pretty early in life. I often tell the story of going to, there must have been one time when we were visiting my grandfather in Ohio, there must have been a time when I went to one of these parties that he had because he was self-made. I mean, he had the luck of being sent to literally secretary school. Now, the way he described it was he knew a state senator who used to come and talk to my great-grandfather that saw something in me. This is my grandfather saying this. And arranged for my great-grandfather to go to secretarial school. And he learned to type and he learned to take shorthand. And he started working as a salesman. And he built a food brokerage later on his own. And he was successful in business. And I remember him being very conflicted about being successful in business as well, because he had money, but and a lot of money by his standards, because he grew up dirt poor. And, I remember when my grandmother was dying of cancer, we would walk and look at the babies and we'd see the young families, and they seemed happy because they were having babies being born. And my grandfather said, those people, look at them, they're happy as hell right now because they have nothing. But the more they get, the less happy they'll be. That made a big impression on me. And I was very young. And that's when he told me I should read the whole Bible, which I did. So I remember these parties that, he had these sales guys working for him. And they all had, Oldsmobile 98s and Cadillac Fleetwoods and Buick Electras and all these early 60s beautiful cars. And on a summer night, all of them waxed, all of them smelling brand new, all of them not with a scrap inside the car, perfectly clean because they all kept their cars perfectly clean. And going to these parties and they'd all be dressed up and there'd be the perfume and they would all have cigarettes in their hands and martinis and they'd be drinking and smoking they were dead, and they were dead within 5 or 6 years of that particular party. And how old were they? They were in their mid-50s. They were 52, 53, some of them 55 when they died. Now, my grandfather was 86 when he died, and his associate was probably 90, Uncle Dave, who came from Wales. We called him Uncle Dave. But life in those days was not long. And I think about these people who are supposedly suffering from cumulative rejection, failure, this idea that in order for us to be happy, we have to have this dream of two cars and a house in the suburbs. But I never wanted that. And I don't judge people that do. I know a lot of people who have had a lot and they died over the years, some very recently, and a number of people my age who struggle with disease, and many of them have a lot. And I've noticed that when people get sick, you know, you have different reactions. Obviously, you feel terrible. I always feel terrible because you don't want that to happen to you. But you try to blame it on something. You know, she lived near the asbestos plant or whatever. And we do it, I think, because we want it to make sense, but it doesn't, because it's in some ways very much random. Like a guy that I knew who went in for an operation on his knees and died just unexpectedly. And this guy was a famous radio programmer who had reached the pinnacle of success as the program director of WABC. When you're 35, you don't have that experience of people just dropping dead with no explanation, unless, of course, you've served in the military and seen combat. But that's a different thing. When you get a little older, you learn that it is, in fact, common. People, yes, do drop dead, and there are no guarantees in life. There is no compact with the founders to guarantee you a happy life, to guarantee me a happy life. It is, in fact, up to all of us. And I think we have reached the point where we believe we have an unattainable idea of success, and we think that somehow we have to be helped. I believe that if you know, I look at these guys, I've been watching these, if you want to see something really incredible, I strongly advise people to watch, I think it's called Five Came Home. It's on Netflix, and it's about the Hollywood directors that five great Hollywood directors, Frank Capra, William Wyler, and a couple other guys that I've now forgotten their names, who went to serve in the military in World War II to make movies in combat. One of them actually went he was there at D-Day on the beach and then went all the way through the war. And I think about the people who went to Vietnam, and I think about the people who went to Korea, and I think about the people who went to Iraq and Afghanistan, and I think about the horrors that many of the people in World War II saw. And yet they came back, and they had simple, normal lives. There's a guy who wrote this book, With the Old Breed, which is probably the best book about the war in the Pacific that I've ever read. And he served as a Marine. You know, he went into the Marines and served as a Marine and was on many of the, you know, really rough battles, Okinawa, Iwo, and everything else. And he came back and for quite a while suffered from PTSD and then finally figured out what he wanted to do, and he became a professor of biology. And that's what he did. And he didn't worry too much about material things. One of the guys who raised the flag on Iwo Jima and was, you know, on the tour and fated by society came back and became an undertaker. So, and he did it because he felt that it was some way to be of service to people. So it's a different perspective of life. You know, I do believe that you have to be smart to figure out a way to succeed, but you don't have to be the smartest guy in the world. Some of the most successful people aren't that smart. You can be smarter, but you can also work harder and you can go along and get along. That's one way. Or you can do whatever it takes. That's one way. And everybody has a different way of approaching things because you do not know when your day is going to come. My dad did everything right. You know, he went to war. He protected his brother throughout the war in his own way. He came back. He went to school. He got a PhD. He was very conservative. He used to tell me, you know, you go to work and you do what you're told and you tell the truth. And he loved his work. He was a chemist. And he did everything right. And he died at 61 years old from ALS. And it was very young for a person to die. I have a brother-in-law who was one of the best people in the world. He cared only about other people. And he died in his late 40s from ALS as well, both of them highly educated. So there's no guarantees. But if you're one of the unfortunate people who has spent a lifetime yearning for something, and I think we're all in that position in some way or another, it used to be that for me, the only thing in the world that mattered was radio. That's all I cared about. It's all I cared about from the time I was 13 years old until a certain point in my life when I realized it was just radio. It was just a job in some ways. And I used to hate it when people said that, because for me, it was an avocation. It was a belief. It was a faith. And then I learned that it didn't care what I thought of it. It didn't return anything to me. And of course, you know, I don't have any money from radio because radio is a terrible business. But anyway, I digress. I learned that there are other ways to succeed. There are other things in life besides all that. And I don't have any expectation that I won't have money or that I won't have a successful business. But the business that I'm doing is a business I want to do. It's a labor of love. It's something I enjoy to do. And I think I've figured out for me some of the key things that were in the way in terms of monetary success before. But it's a process. Life is a process, and you change. And it's hard to believe you don't think that you'll ever change when you're 35 years old or when you're 25. You don't think you'll ever change, but you change a lot. And I just want to say finally that on this warrior front, so all these people, and they usually talk about, they mean Appalachia, they mean Appalachia, they mean the hillbillies. They talk about J.D. Vance, who wrote this book about growing up in a hillbilly family. And they're all drunks. And here's a quote from J.D. Vance from his book. "Our homes are a chaotic mess. We scream and yell at each other like we're spectators at a football game. At least one member of the family uses drugs, sometimes the father, sometimes the mother, sometimes both. At especially stressful times, we'll hit and punch each other. We choose not to work when we should be looking for jobs. Sometimes we'll get a job, but it won't last. We'll get fired for being tardy or for stealing merchandise and selling it on eBay or for having a customer complain about the smell of alcohol on our breath." This horrible vision of white trash and of hopelessness, which, by the way, used to be not just limited to that. It's also offered as an excuse or a reason why life on the Indian reservations is terrible, because of a sense of hopelessness, a sense of defeat. So a defeated people can't summon the psychic energy to crawl out of it, supposedly. So you kind of have to have a warrior mentality, and you kind of have to have a warrior practice, whether it's martial arts or some sort of physical practice, and you have to stay away from drinking. I have a lot of friends who have basically been drinking their entire lives, and I can see them fading away. I can see them losing focus and losing the light and the will to continue. And for the people that have been doing drugs all this time, well, all I can say is this. You know, I did all that, and I had to stop. But I cannot imagine myself being 60 years old or 55 years old or 45 years old, and for the first time having to go in and sit down and say, my name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic or I'm a drug addict, and realize that you literally wasted 90% of your life. When I first got sober, somebody said to me once, "You have saved yourself years of grief." And that one thing, sobriety, is probably the single best thing that I ever did and in my life. And I'm not bragging. I'm just saying, if you're one of those people, or if someone you love is one of those people, they're giving up their life. And if there's a lot of that going on in places that we're talking about with poorly educated white people, let's say, then I can understand why it leads to an early death. And so we have to summon this from ourselves. The government isn't going to grant us some level of peace. They certainly haven't helped the Indians. You know, they haven't helped other people who have been in the same position. Those people have had to help themselves. There's a show on TV that everybody should see called Billions. And in Billions, the businessman is supposed to be the villain. But I see the U.S. attorney more and more as the villain. And there's a scene, and I'm not going to tell you about what leads up to it because it'll give it away. But there's something in Billions that's just fascinating. And that is that at one point, the billionaire is going to do something to this small town. And he finally goes to his wife and asks her advice about what she thinks that he should do. And you know, the implication is, you're supposed to be helping the small town. You're supposed to be helping these people. You shouldn't, you know, whatever. And she says, as one of the characters put it, everybody's a libertarian until it happens to their town. And she turned to her husband and said, and remember, they live on Long Island. They're, you know, super rich. They have a house worth $230 million, you know. And she turns around and says, "Hey, who helped us when we grew up poor. Nobody. We had to help ourselves. So, you know what? Do what you got to do. We're still in the position of having to help ourselves. Just because we have a billion dollars or more doesn't mean that we should be expected to change our behavior in that respect. And it's an interesting thought. Don't give up the fight. Don't give up the fight. Never quit. Never give up. Never give up. So yeah, remember Ryan Plumbing and Heating for leaky faucets and leaky toilets? You need a plumber that can do quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. A lot of times people, they think they can fix this stuff and they half-ass it and it doesn't work and you're still paying the high water bills. 651-224-4771 in St. Paul, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, online at ryanplumbing.com. Well, it's all about economics, and it's all about jobs these days, and it's all about bringing jobs back to the United States. And if your company, if you work for a company that manufactures parks overseas, you may be thinking about bringing some of your manufacturing back to the United States. Now, I've said it before, there are reasons to manufacture in the U.S., but if you're considering bringing manufacturing back to the United States, remember DepoStar, American Design, Engineering, and Manufacturing, right in Ramsey, Minnesota. Visit their website at DepoStar.com. Well, that's going to do it for podcast 618. The American dream is killing us. Maybe we just need to adjust the American dream, right? Thanks for liking and sharing and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and listening to the Bob Davis podcasts right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com, the audio stream, or clicking on individual podcasts and listening to them, subscribing right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com, iTunes, and also listening on Stitcher.com, TuneIn, and blogtalkradio.com. Thanks for listening to podcast 618.
Through my bad fortune.